Now visualize the knee ends of the femur bones as being supported by a hanger, just as you do in constructive rest. As you image the weight of the femur head resting in the acetabula, in the socket. Again, the knee ends you visualize floating or supported by an imaginary hanger. The pelvic ends are projecting into the femur sockets, the acetabula. And now let's do another exercise here. We're going to now begin to think about the crease in the iliofemoral joint. You did that on the first lesson. Probably it's been lost upon you, but we want to review that now. We imaged the crease that's made by the thigh and the pelvis as you were visualizing yourself as a pair of pants to be quite deep. So now we're going to do that again. And this time, I want to physicalize it by having you fold the trunk of your body onto your thighs. Just let the body rest on the thighs. Now, something that can help you here, if you think of the knee ends of the femur bones extending, releasing into space, this is the same thing you were doing when you bounced on the femur heads, and I asked you to let the weight drop out of the knees. This is another way of doing it, by thinking of the femur heads extending out into space. Now, that will let your folding be more compact and easier. In this position, let the fold be as deep as it will be. Give it permission to fold completely, but don't force it into folding with voluntary effort or movement. Just let the weight of the body fold onto the thighs. Now, unfold. And as you unfold, continue to let the knee ends of the femur bones extend. Now what you did was a trunk flexion at the iliofemoral joint. The folding of the trunk of your body at the iliofemoral joint. Let's do a little series of those by gently rocking. I call this the forward rock. And this is the sitting counterpart to the femur balance and standing to help make it more dynamic. Now, as you do the forward rock here, you can also reduce it to where it becomes almost imperceptible, even as you can do it larger. But it's a way of making the sitting very dynamic, even if you only did the image. And when you're in a theater or something and you can't move around and you begin to get a little static, this is a good way to break the staticness. Just do a little bit of the forward rock, whatever room you have or space you have for movement, in addition to the other things I'm giving you for sitting. Now, as you're sitting, let's do a thigh flexion at the iliofemoral joint. You just did a trunk flexion. You can also flex the thigh. I want to show you an image for that on the screen here. It's not literal. It's somewhat abstract. So you can take your thigh and gently bring it up towards your body. Now you don't have to force that. It is important that you be folded all the way. I just want you to think of the fold of both the knee and the thigh being deep, giving it permission to be as deep as it will. And again, the knee ends of the femur bones can extend. Note that I've made that very long there to create that image of the knee. You can let it shoot into space. You could imagine your knee fold, or this, the knee end of the femur as it's folded, extending to the ceiling. It'd be fine. And the best way to do this is to let your weight continue to rest on the two sit bones. And then don't fold any more than what that permits. And then you can unfold. And then unfold at the knee. Okay. Now, this folding that we're doing is going to encompass, I didn't mention this earlier, but I should have, not only the thigh folds, but also the knee and the ankles. So let's just fold the ankles, see how foldable they can be. All right. And then let's come back to where the lower leg is vertical to the floor. And now let's do the folding of the other leg, the one you didn't do before. Let's fold it. Leave your weight on your two sit bones. And watch the knee as it folds extend into the ceiling indefinitely. Then let's unfold extend by unfolding at the knee, and then let's fold at the ankle. Pardon? Well, yes, every time you extend at the ankle, the knee comes down to respond to that. That's what you're talking about. And every time you flex the ankle, there's going to be some small flexion at the knee. You must let that happen. Definitely. Just want you to see how foldable the ankle can be, how soft. Just to check that out. And then let's come back to perpendicular with the lower leg. Now, once again, let's review the femur head folding back into the acetabula, that is the thigh socket. Take your hands once again and draw them back. And then just leave them in the acetabula. And just imagine the two rounded heads of the femur bones dropping in those cups, resting in the cups. Okay. Now let's review the great trochanters melting down the sides of the leg, those formations on the sides of the leg there. Just let them melt or grow or extend. All right. Now let's take the eyes. Let's review that. The eyeballs are going to be resting in the deep eye sockets. Just like the femur bone. And then you can touch the temples, the sides of your head there, around the sides of the eyes, and let those melt just like the great trochanters did. And that way you'll get a deeper experience of the eyes resting in their socket. Now, while you're touching the eyes, let's go back in imagination to the thighs. Let the thigh heads, again, the femur heads, rest in the acetabula, in their sockets. And the great trochanters melt down the sides of the legs. Eyeballs rest in the eye sockets, and the sides, the temples, melt downward. Now see if you can see those two images at the same time, simultaneously. Now, take one hand away and put it in the opposite thigh crease to the eye that you're touching. And let's see that femur head sink in the acetabulum, the thigh socket, as the eye sinks in its own. And the great trochanter melt down the side of the leg, and the temple, the side of the head, melt downward, soften. Then let's reverse. Touch the other eye and opposite femur crease. Let's watch the femur head sink in the femur socket and the eyeball sink in the eye socket. And the great trochanter melt down the side of the leg and the side of the head. The temple melt down the cheekbone. You can slowly open the eyes, or let the eyes open slowly, let the light seep in, and begin to let the objects in the room come into your range of vision rather than you reaching out to get them or to see them. Slowly reorient yourself with your surroundings. And let's do the forward rock again, just very small. And each time as you rock forward, let the femur heads drop back into the femur socket. And the eyeballs fall into their eye socket. And then let's see the knee ends of the femur bones extending as you go forward, even as the femur heads drop back into their sockets. Now this is designed to help you in another way release the knee ends of the femur bones. We're going to do it in standing in a minute again. So this is a little practice in sitting. Now that's happening in the background, and as you continue to rock forward and back, be aware that all three of the joints we just worked on, the thigh joint, the knee joint, and the femur joint, are all responding with slight movement, folding and unfolding as you move forward and back. Ever so slight, give them the option of being mobile, flexible, so that you haven't locked any one of them. Now let's come to the standing position. We'll work with this in a little movement. Let's review the idea of the weight resting on the femur head. Look at your lines of support here in the great trochanters, which are melting down. And let's do a little bounce on the femur head. That would be like the forward rock in sitting. Let's bounce. Now, let's just touch the great trochanters. Let them melt down the sides of the legs. As you see the support in between. Touch your sit bones for a moment. Think of your head between the sit bones easily. And then let's let the sit bones melt down the backs of the legs. And once again, a little bouncing on the femur heads. All right. Now let's add the folding. As you bounce, in fact, before you bounce, I want to do this. The plie is a good example of that three-way folding we just worked on. So let me get out of the line there. Let's do this. Let's do a simple plie in which we let the thigh creases be foldable, just as you did earlier when you were working on the bench. Just want to bring that into your awareness and then unfold. And then again, let's fold, being aware of the depth of the thigh creases. That's right. Now, let's go down to the knees in our thought. Fold again. See how foldable the knees can be. And again, let's fold, seeing how foldable the knees can be. It's just simple plie and come out. And then once again, let's fold, and this time the ankle folds are very deep. And unfold. And again, let's fold, let the ankles be very foldable. And then let's come out of that. Now, once again, let's bounce on the femur heads. And as you're doing that bouncing, let the thigh folds be very foldable. Give them permission to be foldable. And the knee folds, very foldable. And the ankle, that's very foldable. Now the reason I'm going through this awareness exercise is that so many of us, even when we ostensibly intend to fold all three joints in a plie, which is what you need to be doing, quite often we are folding or pushing against a great resistance. And what we need to do is to take the brakes off to let the folding be there to begin with. Don't have to work against a resistance. And then what we do quite often in walking, we hold one or more of those joints rigid so that the walk can't flow, it can't be smooth. So let's just walk a little bit now and check ourselves out. See how foldable you can let the joints be. Now you can think of them in any sequence that you wish. You can think of all of them at once or one side at once, or one pair at once, or just one joint. But use this time now as an awareness process so that you just check yourself out to see if you're letting these various joints have their full ability. Watch the wires on this side of the room. Maybe we should come to this side. Okay, now let's put this to a little more of a test. Let's go back to the walk bounce that we were doing. And I'll just repeat that for you. Well, we just took a step, we walked, bounce, and step, bounce. It's bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce. Let's do that again. Bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce. Let's bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce. You got it. That's it. Bounce, and bounce, 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 bounce. Lift the weight out of the knee, and bounce, bounce, and bounce, bounce, and bounce, 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 and bounce, 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 bounce. Now, just walk for a moment. And take whatever kinesthesia you have from that. It will follow into your movement. There ought to be just an element of that when we walk, when we move. We should have a little, there should be a little sparkle to the walk. It shouldn't be dragging. It shouldn't be dragging. Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to climb the stairs with a bounce. Yesterday, we just stepped on the step, but today, instead of that somewhat passive way of climbing the stairs, which is all right, it's fine, we're going to step on it and bounce it, and step and bounce. I just want to show you how you can get a kind of a lift out of movement with this simple, nonviolent way of moving, and yet it can be quite dynamic. If you want to put your shoes on, please feel free to do, or whatever you feel like. The three planes of movement. We are three-dimensional creatures in a three-dimensional world. And so there are three planes of movement that we can move in, or that movement can take place through us. And I'm going to give you those three now. Just put a label on them, really. You know them already. There's the plane of movement front to back, which has traditionally been called the sagittal plane. Sometimes called the anterior posterior plane, which is very good because it's very descriptive. Second plane of movement, plane on the movement goes side to side. That's called the coronal or frontal. And the third plane of movement is, well, those two planes are what we call vertical planes. The reference being the standing position you see here. So those two planes are vertical. The third plane of movement is horizontal. And that's what you call it, horizontal plane. Sometimes called transverse. Okay. Now, let's come to standing and let's move in those three planes so we connect the label with the movement. First, let's just do a little short, simple movement in the sagittal plane or anterior posterior. That would be just simply what you do every day, which is to walk. You walk in that plane. And then standing in place, let's move the leg in the sagittal plane. And the arm in the sagittal plane. And the head in the sagittal plane. The body, trunk of the body in the sagittal plane. The hand in the sagittal plane. All right. Now, how about the coronal plane? Let's move in the coronal plane. You don't usually move in it, but sometimes in dance or athletics or martial arts, you do. Okay, and then you can move the arms in the sagittal and the coronal plane. And you can move the trunk of the body in the coronal plane, side bend or side lateral flexion. And the head. The transverse plane. How would you move the body in the transverse plane there? There you go. That's transverse. Then if you want to just move the arm, say, in the transverse plane, that gives you a good sense of cutting through. And if you have a very good extension, you move the leg in the transverse plane, which I don't have. Okay. Now, we sometimes in kinesiology say the sagittal plane, and very loosely we're referring to a very special one. In terms of these planes of movement, in any of them, there is a possibility for an infinite number of planes, because a plane, by mathematical definition, has no thickness. So there can be an infinite number of planes going front to back. But sometimes we want a special one, which we just sometimes say the sagittal plane or the coronal plane or the transverse plane. And the one we mean really, if we were more accurate, is the median plane, or sometimes it's called the cardinal. Median or cardinal means the same thing. Right? Now, here's what that plane is. It's the plane that passes through the axis of gravity in the case of the two vertical planes. So, the cardinal sagittal plane is going to pass through the axis, this central axis here, dividing the body into a left half and a right half. Plane passing through the central axis, dividing the body into left half and the right half. Okay? The cardinal coronal plane will pass through the axis of gravity, going side to side, dividing the body into a front half and a back half. And the median or cardinal transverse plane is going to pass through the center of gravity, which is down here in front of the sacrum, and that's going to divide the body into an upper and a lower half. Now, where the cardinal sagittal and cardinal coronal meet, there is a line formed. What is that line? What is the line where the cardinal coronal and the cardinal sagittal plane meet? Mm-hmm. That's right. Do you all see that? It's better if you can possibly image it or visualize it, but if you can't do that, you can simply deduce it, because if both planes pass through the same line, that means they're intersecting there. You can do that mentally. That's the way I had to do it for a long time, because my visualization for that was not very good. But if you could possibly visualize it, learn to do that, it will help you get a sense of where that center line is. We're going to be working with the center line. We've just started, as a matter of fact. I'm sneaking into it. Now, where the three cardinal planes meet, that is the sagittal, coronal, and transverse, there is a point formed where three planes would meet. What is the point? Center of gravity, that's correct. There's a good picture in Human Movement Potential, Swigart's book there, with some drawings that create optical illusions that may help you with that. Now, one more thing before we leave this for just a few minutes to take up something else and come back to it. There are anatomical landmarks through which the coronal planes pass, the two vertical ones, the ones I want to deal with. With the sagittal, it passes through the pubic symphysis that we've discussed, through the sternum, including the xiphoid process, the body of the sternum, the manubrium. And if your head is in alignment through the nose and then over what is called the median line of the skull here. And that is another way that we will, if we have some time, work to get a sense of alignment. Again, without being rigid about it, but simply these anatomical landmarks give us a kind of a reference which we can use advantage. Now, the cardinal coronal plane will pass through actually the atlanto-occipital joint, where the head joins to the head, spine. But for simplicity and for workability, we would just think of it passing through the ears. It will also pass through the acromion tips, or processes here, which are your shoulder tips. And then through the iliofemoral joint. In this picture that you have here, you can't see the line on that because it's too light. That is to say, there's too much light in the room. Maybe you can see it on the chart down here. The artist here has it going through the knees and the ankles. Through the ankles, fine. I like to have the knees a little forward of that so they aren't quite so locked. But it's okay if it goes to the knees. If you know how to keep your knees in that alignment without locking, that's fine. Those are anatomical landmarks, and we'll be using those as references for imagery a little later on. Okay. Now, I want to show you another picture. No, first I want to expand on the line of the central line. I'll show you about that. Let's take this central axis here and remove it. Put it in space. Back to that. I have a slide that I'll show you in a minute. Now, I refer to that as the central axis of the body. What it's actually called more nearly correctly is the axis of gravity. And it's defined as a line imagined, created by the force of gravity, and passing through the center of gravity of the body. In other words, what you're doing is imagining the line of gravity passing through the center of gravity of your body. Now, the center of gravity of an object is that point around which the weight is centered. Quite often it's defined as that point at which gravity is acting equally on the object. Or it's that point at which, if the object were suspended, there would be no tendency to rotation. All three of those mean exactly the same thing. And in a regular shaped object, such as a cube, I'll draw the cube, the square of the cube, the geometrical center, which is equidistant from all sides, or in a sphere, I can't with this angle of drawing approximate these things any more accurately. The geometric center of a regular shaped object is equidistant from all sides. And that's easy to visualize. In this case, the geometric center and the center of gravity coincide. They're the same. So in such an object, it's easy to imagine where the center of weight is, the center of gravity. In the human body, it's not all that easy. I told you before that the center of gravity is in front of the sacrum, upper part of the sacrum, off the bone. That's where it's been estimated to be, and it's going to vary with varying structures. As a matter of fact, generally in women, it's lower than in men. So there's a variance there, but that's approximately where it is. So again, the axis of gravity is a line of the force of gravity imagined through the center of gravity of the body. That's the center line. Another good way to think about that, if you know what a plumb line is, do you all know what a plumb line is? You know what the carpenters use when they are going to build a wall or a structure that must rise? They will take a string with a weight on the end, usually lead, and let it hang. Now that weight
I should just
backtrack and tell you what gravity is. I don't really know. Nobody does. But I'll give you a definition of it. Gravity is defined as the attraction between objects and the Earth. That is, if the object is in the gravitational field of the Earth. So this attraction between the object and the Earth, which we know is there, is defined as the force of gravity. And this force, then, this attraction, if you have a weight on a piece of string, will pull the string in the gravitational line. Then if you line up a structure that's going to rise, it's vertical, with that string, the structure is then in the line of gravity, which helps it to balance, reduces the stress on it. If the structure is not in the line of gravity, gravity will tend to topple it. Do you see that just as a matter of experience that you see every day? So this plumb line is actually what you are visualizing through your body passing through the center of gravity of the body. Now, we're going to work with that center of gravity a bit, and we're going to use it as an image. It's rather important in terms of getting a sense of your center. That's part of what we mean by being centered. Let's work with that line for a moment in our imagination. Come to standing, and I'll lead you through some processes that will help you to get there. Okay? First thing that you can do is to balance on the femur heads. Then, I don't want to regiment you, so if you want to, you can face any wall that you like. If this isn't appropriate for you, you have another wall that you have as a favorite, then face that wall. But what I'd like to have you do with that, as you do it, is to imagine the cardinal coronal plane passing through your body and see it as being parallel to the wall that's in front of you. And that's going to pass through the acromion processes and the ears and the iliofemoral joints and the ankles. And then see the cardinal sagittal plane passing through the pubic symphysis and the sternum and the nose and right over the median line of the skull. And where those two planes, that plane is perpendicular to the wall in front of you, or parallel to the wall beside you, or both. And where you see or visualize or image the two planes meeting, that's your central axis. Now, if that is not a way that you can think about the central axis, if that's not useful for you, then just imagine yourself as a cylinder and see a center line through that. Whatever way you see the center line through your body, would you now walk imaging the center line? And again, I want to remind you, please, the cords here, that's not good policy. As you walk away from them and walk in that end of the room so we don't run the risk of toppling them. Okay. Let's expand this image. You're walking with the central axis as an image through the center of you, and that's your substance, the central axis. The rest of you is shadow. And now let the shadow, the rest of you, melt away, and you're just a central axis moving through space. Pencil thin, central axis moving through space. Now, you can stay where you are for just a moment, and you can face, again, your favorite wall. And now we're going to move around the axis. That is, we're going to move in the horizontal or transverse plane, and that is going to create a circle, which I've given an impression of in that drawing. Let me show you how you'll do that, and then we'll all do that together. You stand. Standing and you're imaging the central axis through your body. The axis itself is not going to move through space. When you did this, you were moving the axis through space with you. This time, you're going to simply move around it by taking little steps to the side, staying in an imaginary circle with your feet, moving around the axis. Now let me show you what needs to be avoided if possible. Moving the axis in space. I did it in a very large way, but many of us will deviate from that axis in a more subtle way. What you want to do is just imagine that that is like a pole running through your body and that you're going to move right around it. Okay, let me just, I know that you've probably seen some of the Mideastern dances in which the dancer will put the finger up here. That's what they're doing. They're creating an axis. They're creating an axis right through the body. If that helps you, you can do that. It's up to you. But I want you to get a sense of moving around the axis. Do one 360-degree turn and then just pause. Try that. Just play with it, have some fun. You know, don't be too careful. And then once you've done 360 degrees, just pause. We'll wait for everybody to finish. A little bouncing on the femur head. Are you evenly on the two? All right. Now one more time in the same direction. Okay, again. Let's balance on the femur heads and renew our sense of the central axis. And let's add one more thing to that. The axis is perpendicular to the floor. Perpendicular to the floor. Just bring that into your awareness, your consciousness. And let's turn the opposite direction, one 360-degree turn around the axis. Mm-hmm. just pause. And then once again, let's rotate around the central axis. And pause when you've made the 360-degree turn. And again, let's just bounce on the femur head. Now, once again, let's walk and carry the axis around with us. And then when you've explored that to your satisfaction, have a seat, and we'll talk about a little more material. As we leave this for the time being, we'll continue that tomorrow. I want to separate fact from imagery. As you were moving, I asked you to image the axis running through the center of your body. And it does that. But that is actually, strictly speaking, for the standing position, that fundamental standing position when you have your weight on both legs. When you take a step, as you shift your weight to the supporting leg for that instant, the center of gravity shifts toward the supporting leg very slightly, and with it, the axis of gravity. When the movement is good, the shift is minimal. For that reason, I didn't ask you to shift the axis in your thinking, but rather to think the axis in the center of the body, even though it's actually shifting, and that will tend to help you center the weight and move more efficiently. But I just wanted you to know the fact from the image. Now, on the screen, you see a spine side view. And I want to talk with you about the spine and build a few images. I'll move through this information rather quickly, and then we'll go into constructed rest, and we're going to do some tactile aid for the spine. Actually, we're not going to do a regular constructed rest. We're going to be working on our sides. The spine is, first of all, a multi-jointed structure. That is to say, it's not one solid piece of material, but rather is composed of segments, which we call vertebrae. And these segments you can see on this skeleton here, you can see on the picture there. Looking at them from the front, they are rounded. And in between each of the rounded bodies of the vertebrae, as they're called, there is what is called an intervertebral disc, which is a tough fibrous cartilage called fibrocartilage. And that fibrocartilage makes up about 1/4 the length of the human spine. It's pretty important in our visualization, our imaging, our concept of it. The cartilage serves two major functions. One, it cushions the shock of the weight going through the spine. Because every time you take a step, there's a tremendous force passing through the compression members of your body, the bones. And these discs serve to cushion that shock. The second important function they serve is to permit a larger range of movement than would be possible if you didn't have them. Now, looking at the spine from the posterior view, you see these little projections, which are really the spines of the spine. We call these processes, actually, spinous processes. These are the posterior ones that point directly to the bodies of the vertebrae, and the ones that flare out from the sides are the lateral posterior processes, which serve as anchors for muscles and ligaments, and they also protect the spinal cord, which is in front of them. If you look at the formation of the vertebra, forming out from the body of the vertebra are these processes, and within, and as I say, in front of the processes, there's a little circle. And you put the circles together, you stack them, and you have a canal. And in that canal, the spinal cord fits. And that takes the vital nerve supply to the brain. So it needs a lot of protection, and these do give that to them in back and on the sides. And in front, of course, you have the bodies of the vertebrae, which are in front of the spinal cord. They offer a tremendous amount of protection there. Let's look at the terminology for the spine. In just a couple of minutes, I can show you how you can memorize all the vertebrae of the spine if you don't already know it. Some of you know anatomy already. But they are organized in sections. The first seven vertebrae are called the cervical vertebrae. That's your neck. The next 12 vertebrae, you have ribs attached to them. We call those thoracic. Seven cervical and 12 thoracic. Immediately below that, you have the five lumbar, which are the small of your back. And then below that, you have this solid sheath here called the sacrum, which is five fused vertebrae that in children is somewhat movable. Below the sacrum, we have the coccyx, which can be anywhere from three to five semi-fused vertebrae. Those are the bones of the spine, roughly. The 24 movable ones plus the sacrum and the coccyx. Spine has curves, as you might notice from that side view and looking at the skeleton from the side. And these curves are important because they permit the spine to do its peculiar job. It has to support weight. It also has to move that weight that it's supporting. And the most efficient structure for that is a curved structure so that movement can flow smoothly through the spine as you locomote. So, in our work, we're not trying to straighten the spine, as sometimes we're advised to do by well-meaning posture teachers or parents or any kind of teachers. We're not trying to do that, but it's more that we're trying to center the spine through lengthening it. And indeed, we don't want the curves to be too pronounced. That is to say, those curves should be there, but they should not be overly curved. Let's look at a simple mechanical drawing of this. Okay, if you have a weight here on a curve, it tends to increase the curvature. If, however, I'm going to do it this way, I want to change the presentation a little bit. You have a series of curves. You have another mechanical law coming into effect, which is that if the curves are opposite, alternating, the tendency to weight bending the curve is reduced. And that's a basic law of mechanics. So we want to have curves in the spine, but we don't want them to be too pronounced, and we need more than one in order to establish a balance of the curves. By having a series, when you have a weight on this structure, it's going to be less likely, that is, the weight has less of a tendency to bend the curves, since the curves changing direction helps the balance of the load. Now, I want to go back to what I started to say. If you have the gravity line here, and you have a curve such as the one that I drew here, then you can see that the weights that are being transmitted through these curves are close enough to the gravity line so that there can be some kind of a balance. If, on the other hand, you have very pronounced curves, the weights are so far from the gravity line that you're going to have to compensate with an awful lot of muscle work to keep the structure upright. So that's what we're into when we talk about lengthening the spine. But there's a little bit of a problem there. I said that the ideal postural pattern is not absolute, which includes the curves of the spine. That is to say, not everyone is going to have the same spinal curvature. And the sacral. And the first differentiation takes place in the cervical, forming the cervical curve, and then later the lumbar curve. Now, if the child is born with a very deep primary curve, then the other curves are going to be compensatory. So, it's very dangerous to try to compare your own curve to somebody else's. In other words, if you're sitting next to someone whose curves appear to be very shallow and you feel that yours should be the same, that's not really a valid goal. Aside from the fact that there's an individual difference in the curvatures of spines to begin with, there is also an individual appearance which is caused by the fact that when you put flesh here over these curves, you can't really tell what's under it. If you look at these processes here, notice they are almost perpendicular to the bodies of the vertebrae here. And you put flesh over that and allow for the individual variation in muscle and flesh development on persons. Some people look as if they have a flat back. Well, the back may be flat, but not the spine. And by the same token, these processes point down very sharply. So put flesh over that, compared to what you have here with these perpendicular positions, I've seen people look as if they have an absolutely flat back. And that's only an illusion, because everyone has curves, and should have them at least. But you really can't tell. So that's another reason why we work the way we do. We're trying through creativity and working with the body and the tactile aid, the creativity and the process and the image, to help the body find its own ideal curvature, its own ideal postural pattern. And that's the first line of movement that we had, the lengthening of the spine downward. You remember those 9 lines of movement. Now, that is what we're going to work on in just a couple of minutes. We'll be going into the sideline position, and we're going to be working on that. I'd like to make just a couple of more comments about the spine. I said that a child has one curve, a primary curve when he's born, and that differentiates into the 4 curves. This, for those of you who may be involved in rearing children, whatever capacity, teachers, parents, or simply friends, it's not a good idea to force a child to stand or sit before they're ready. Now, how do you know they're ready? They tell you, you don't tell them. The child, if allowed to develop properly, unless there's some problem which can occur, but not usually does it occur, will, through its little movements, those little movements they do, kicking, rolling, crawling, creeping, crying, all of those activities tend to develop the muscles which help develop and establish the curves of the spine. When that process has come to a point at which there is sufficient strength there for the curves to be maintained in an upright position, the child will begin to sit. It's usually preceded quite a bit with a lot of creeping on all fours as opposed to crawling on belly. And very shortly thereafter, it will begin to stand and walk. The timing of that varies in individual. It's like each person has a biological time clock within them. And if a child walks earlier or sits up earlier than another child, it doesn't mean that child is superior, really. It's just that the timing is different in the two children, if you might be comparing them. What can thwart that, among the many things that can thwart it, that process of development, is if the child isn't allowed a proper space to move in. It really needs either a room, or a small room, or part of a room with a lot of space, a rug, a warm rug, and no sharp objects around, where it can move, it can roll, it can crawl, it can creep very freely, and move pretty much as it wants to. What tends to depress that process, to interfere with it, to inhibit it, is cooping a child up in a crib all day long. That's not a good idea, because then they don't get a chance to do the movement they need to do. Then the process can be thwarted, slowed, inhibited. Those little devices that make the child sit up, do avoid them. They can be used after the child is strong enough to sit up. But don't force the child to sit up. I feel that a psychological and physiological trauma is established In some children, it wouldn't happen in all of them, but in some, if they are forced to sit up or stand up too soon. Now, let's do this to help our imagery of lengthening the spine. We have talked about smoothing of the horizontal wrinkles downward, which is a very good image. But I want to be more specific today so you really get to zero in on lengthening the spine. I'm going to start off very generally by using an image of the coccyx. Now, anthropologists tell us that the coccyx is a vestigial tail. And what they mean by that is that at one time, according to the theory of anthropology, we had full-grown tails as members of the primate family, our antecedents. As a matter of fact, it's thought to have been prehensile. That is, it has grasping properties. You know, monkeys can pick things up with their tails. And that this that we have here, this thing we call the coccyx, is a vestige of that at one time full-grown tail. It is atrophied as a result of non-use. What we're going to do this morning is to devolve instead of evolve. Back into eons of time, we're going to regrow the tail through imagery. So touch your coccyx now. You can feel it. All right. And now watch the coccyx in your imagination grow into a longer and longer and longer tail. It'll curve slightly forward, following the curvature you see there, forward to the knees and then in between the ankles and on down through the floor, as long as you want to see it. Now, I'm going to have all of us do a little exercise to get into the spirit of this, and then I'm going to be very specific. This is a little general, but it's just to get you into this. Come to standing now, and image the tail growing, and if you want to have some fun with it, image the tail of your favorite animal. If you're friendly with a cat, a dog, or like monkeys or any pigs, any tail that you like to image, you can do, even a dinosaur's tail. Back in my day, that's what they had. So let's do some walking now, imaging long, long tail growing longer as you walk. Just have some fun with it. I just want you to get into the spirit of this before I get very specific. Step on your tail. Yeah, you can swing it around. Okay, now just stand wherever you happen to be for a moment, and let's go back to the idea of resting the weight on the femur heads and letting the great trochanters melt down the sides of the legs. And you can do a little bouncing with that if you like. And as you bounce on the femur head, just tell yourself that you can let the great trochanters melt down the sides of your legs because the femur heads are supporting the weight. So you don't need to hold yourself up by your great trochanters. And the sit bones can melt down the backs of your legs because the femur heads are giving you support. So let them melt down the backs of your legs. And the spine, the tail of the spine, can grow down to the heels. You can release the tail of your spine because your weight is resting on your femur head. You don't have to hold yourself up by your coccyx. Let go of it. Release it. Let the weight rest on the femur head. If you want to bounce a little to activate it, all right, you don't have to. So you've got three points now that are non-support points: the great trochanters, the sit bones, and the coccyx. Todd used to say, never use your coccyx as a lever for leverage action. That's what she meant. Just what I showed you. Now, here's what we're going to do lying on our sides. We're going to watch the processes here as if they themselves were little tails dropping down. And while you're lying on your side, we're going to touch you on the individual processes. We'll start down around mid-sacrum and work our way up as high as we can get. We'll get to shoulder level. We may not do every one between the sacrum and the shoulders, but we'll do many of them, or most of them. So the image is very simple. As your partner is touching you on the process, you're going to see the process fold downward. It could even lengthen downward. And as we get to certain stages, and you can do it in your mind anytime you want to, even though we don't say it, I'm going to ask you to think of the one that you're on as it tumbles downward or lengthens downward or folds downward, triggering off the ones below it. So they all tumble down in a flowing action like a row of dominoes, and all of that merges into the tail image. So that no matter where you are, as you think about the processes dropping, it's always a flowing action that extends on into the tail image of the tailbone lengthening. Now, when we're down in the sacrum, we're going to have to estimate the space between the processes because they are quite small down here. As you get up into the lumbar and higher, you'll be able to feel them because they project very definitely outward. So we can just go from one to the other. You'll feel them. All right, let's set the mats up. And I want you to lie on your side, and you're going to need more support than you did for your head when you lie on your back. Line your back up with the plane, the wall behind you. Line your back up with the wall behind you. Line your back up with the wall behind you. your pardon? You can do that. That's very good. Now, if you wish to, you can take something and put between your knees and your ankles to give you a little better support. You should be lying on your rib cage with the shoulder relaxed under you. And it might be, if you can't do that comfortably, that you need more support under your head. Okay, now the first thing that we're going to do is to take the flat of our hand and just brush it down the back of the partner to establish that the back is parallel to the wall behind it. Then take your fingers and put them on the processes themselves, those posterior spinous processes, and run your fingers down those posterior spinous processes to get a sense of where your partner's spine is. You can feel them. Just do that couple of times. All right. Now go down into the sacrum. And just touch very gently, and you're pushing down toward the heels, really, the feet, very lightly. And your partner images that the process bends down or bends toward the coccyx because it softens. And then it can grow all the way to the coccyx. And then we come up about a half inch. That's approximately the distance between the processes. It would vary on individual structures, but estimate. There's nothing critical here. And again, you watch the process soften, bending toward the coccyx, and growing toward the coccyx. Now, this is an instance in which I think it's better if you're facing the direction in which the image is moving, which is toward your partner's coccyx. You can be either sitting or whatever you wish alongside your partner, facing the direction of the movement. It helps you as you give the movement to go with it. Don't forget, you're using the image as you give the tactile aid. Let's come up now another half inch. Watch the process fold, soften, and then just extend down the length of the spine all the way to the coccyx. Then we come up another half inch. By now you may be into the lumbar area and you can just feel the processes, so you don't have to estimate. You just go to the succeeding ones above. But anyway, let's stay on this a moment as we watch the process soften, folding toward the coccyx, growing toward the coccyx. And come up another one. That's good. Very nice. At this point, let's use the domino image. Leave your finger on the process which you're touching. Take the fingers of the other hand and from there run them down the spine toward the coccyx a couple of times to give your partner the tactile aid for the domino effect. And then you can leave your second finger touch at the lower end of the spine, giving your partner a kind of a perspective. It helps to set up a target for the image, a goal for the image. Very good. Very nice. And then let's come up now another process. And just watch it soften and fold and extend down to the coccyx again. That's the way. Keep watching it. Keep letting it happen. Okay, let's move up another one. We'll watch the process drop, fold, soften. Another thing you can let happen is let it jiggle a little bit. Let it wiggle around. Just not voluntary movement, but watch it happen. That's it. That helps to change the pattern. Come up another process. And one more. Again, see it soften and folding and growing down to the coccyx. Come up another process. Another. And one more. Okay, now wherever you are, I want you to come up to shoulder level approximately. And we're going to drop this process, let it soften and fold downward. That's good. And all the processes below now are going to be triggered by that one, and they're all going to fold down. And the movement, the lengthening, goes all the way through the coccyx. So we get this domino effect of lengthening the spine all the way from shoulder level on down through the tailbone and beyond. Look at that happening, and then when it does, you can repeat it if you wish. Keep letting it happen. Just watch it easily. All right, now you can take your tack to laid away. Let me ask people in sideline position to roll onto your hands and knees. You may have to take the foam rubber from between your partner's legs. And once you get onto your hands and knees, sit back on your heels for a moment with your body upright. And then fold the trunk of your body onto your thighs and let it rest on your thighs the way you did when you sat. And think of the creases in both the knees and the thighs being extra deep, extra deep. And give them permission to be foldable. And think of the knee ends of the femur bones extending. And think of the spine elongating, what we just did. All the processes tumbling downward, merging into the tail image. And as you unfold, think of the knee ends of the femur bones extending, and the spinous process is dropping, merging into a tail image. Unfold with that set of imagery. Think of as much of it as you can. If you can't think of it all, do what you can. Once you've unfolded, come to standing however you like. I'll have a structured way in another lesson, but I don't want to jump ahead to that now. Just come up whatever way you like. And balance on the femur heads. Let the sit bones hang very long because you're balanced on the femur heads. And the head between the sit bones. And the great trochanter is melting down the sides of your legs because you're resting on the femur heads. And then the tailbone growing into the floor, forward slightly between the ankles, between the knees and then the ankles. And we'll bounce, just a tiny bounce on the femur head. Okay, please help your partner into the sideline position. We'll work on him or her.
Thank you.
line your back up with the wall behind you.
In the office.
On your rib cage, your shoulders are relaxed under you. Maybe if you double the pillow, it would give you more support. You need a little more support. That is, will it fold over? You got a book? All right, you can do it that way. And just consider that you need a certain amount of support under your head so that the shoulder can relax under you and you can be resting on your ribs. All right, now take the palm of your hand and run it down your partner's back. Just think of your back as being very long and very broad and parallel to the wall behind you. And again, that's not a rigid relationship. You're not holding your back that way. It's just that it is that way. Then take your fingers and run them down the processes. This is a preview of the dropping of the spinous processes. It gives you an opportunity to feel where your partner's spine is. You get familiar with it. And remember now, you're going to be using the imagery yourself as you give the tactile aid. So as your partner drops the spinous process, you join your partner. Go down to mid-sacrum. And we'll drop a process there. Just let it soften and fold toward the coccyx and extend to the coccyx. Merge with the coccyx. And come up a half inch, approximately. And let this one soften. Fold toward the coccyx and merge with the coccyx. And we'll come up another half inch. Let the process wiggle, jiggle, just any kind of motion in your thinking so that you change your habitual pattern. Let's take another one. Harry. By now, you're probably into the lumbar area and you can feel the processes, so you don't have to estimate. That's good. Just let it drop. Let's come up one more process now and watch it soften, fold toward the coccyx, grow toward the coccyx, extend. That's right, just let go of it. Come up another one. Right, let's come up one more. And here we'll do the domino effect. As you see this one folding toward the coccyx, it tumbles all the ones below and they all fold toward the coccyx, and that action merges into the coccyx lengthening, the tail image that we started off with. Okay, let's come up another one. The important thing here is to keep the image moving. So if you let the process fold, again, once you reach it folding and lengthening down, it must keep doing what it's doing. Or if you've gone far enough with that, then dismiss the image and start over, or even rest your mind. But don't hold on to the image being still or steady. Let's come up another one now and watch it move down, fold down, grow to the coccyx. Now let's come up to, no matter where you are, let's move up to the one that's shoulder level, about that, just estimate, and do the domino effect by running your fingers of the other hand down the processes right through the coccyx and our partner sees that smooth flowing of all the processes tumbling down, growing down, merging into the tail, and they all lengthen into infinity. Look at it happen, and also give it permission to happen. Partner has anything between the knees and the ankles, take that from, and then you can roll over onto your hands and knees as you see fit, and sit back on your heels. And then fold the trunk of your body on your thighs and just rest there for a few moments. Give the foldings at the knees and the iliofemoral joints permission to be entirely foldable. And to help that along, release the knee ends of your femur bones. And think of the processes again tumbling down, folding down, softening down, merging into the tail image. And unfold with as much of that imagery as you can until you're sitting on your heels. Now you can come to standing whatever way you like and balance on your femur heads. And the great trochanters are melting down the sides of your legs and the femur heads are in between. That's to help you get a line up on where they are so that you begin to get a sense of femur heads being between the great trochanters. And then because you're resting your weight on your femur head, you can let the sit bones release into length. Let them go wherever they want to go. And then because the weight is resting on the femur head, you can let the spine release the tail. And you can start that release by seeing the spinous processes tumble downward, merging into the tail image. And a little bouncing on the femur heads to activate that. Let me give you an assignment, and then we're going to spend a couple of minutes doing an improvisation with movement. I would suggest that you get a copy of The Thinking Body. Just borrow it if you don't have it. And I think on page 81, there's a picture of three spines. And trace those. It will help you get a feeling for the spine. The other picture to trace is a side view of the skeleton and draw in the axis of gravity. Quite a number of anatomy books have the axis of gravity in it. If you have Todd's book or Swigart's, they both have some picture with the axis of gravity through it. It'd be nice if you did that. And I may have a few comments to make on that axis of gravity, perhaps. So if you get a chance, do that. You could also read the chapter on the spine in Todd's book and the one on human move potential by Swigart if you want to do some reading. Okay, now here's what I'd like to have you do for the improvisation. I want you to explore the iliofemoral joint that we've talked about yesterday and today, and to utilize that in movement in whatever ways you can, to be creative. What kind of movement can you execute at the iliofemoral joint? Of course, you can bounce on them, you can rotate them, extend the leg from the joint, anything you wish to do. Carol is going to supply a little music for us, a little accompaniment. Might be a good idea to start by doing some bouncing on the femur bones in some particular way, whatever movement you do, just to get into that. You don't have to be standing on your femurs to use them, use the joint. Explore some different levels of movement. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was beautiful. See you tomorrow. Have a good day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.